us going slow. Look at those demonstrators talk of town, green and brown, picking them up and laying them down by your friends and fools. That's what they like to call them there in the class, all alone. The only way for them to lose is to cheat them. You may tie them, but you never beat them. Spread your stuff, boy, you won't do nothing different. Cakewalking babies from home.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and you can hear us at accesssacramento.org. Today's program includes The War Over Climate with Eric Pooley and Eli Kintish from August 18, 2010. Francesca Viana talks with Eric Pooley about the politics of climate change. His book is The Climate War, True Believers, Power Brokers, and the Fight to Save the Earth. Also, Eli Kintish talks about geoengineering. His book is Hacking the Planet, Science's Best Hope or Worst Nightmare for Averting Climate Catastrophe. This is 59 Minutes. And then after that, Scott Horton interviews Andrew Basevich from August 9, 2010. Andrew Basevich is a professor of international relations at Boston University and the author of Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. He discusses the bipartisan business of war-making, the destructive patriotism of Washington power elite, and why military power is useless at affecting positive social change. This is 9 minutes. And then after that, from Living on Earth, on October 1st, 2010, Yellow Dirt, Navajo country provided a significant share of America's Cold War uranium, but when the mining companies walked away, no one told the people not to build houses out of the material left behind. This is also 9 minutes.
In other words, to try to go along with cutting our carbon emissions, to try to find some way to protect the planet from heating.
Right. The other reason that it was the engineering that dare not speak its name is that scientists really feared if you talked about some sort of cooling mechanism for the atmosphere, you might dissuade people that we have to take aggressive steps to stop putting up all the pollution we're putting up with carbon emissions. But actually, geoengineering would only work as a kind of parallel procedure. You have to be cutting the greenhouse gases, which are warming the planet, at the same time that you even consider cooling means.
One of the methods that you talk about is by injecting aerosols into the atmosphere, sulfur dioxide, much like the Pinatubo solution, or as we're seeing now, the Iceland volcano, which is doing that. Gee, Mount Pinatubo doesn't seem to have hurt the climate of the Earth. It protected us, gave us a few more years of cooling. What's the downside?
Mount Pinatubo erupted in 1991. It spewed about 10 million tons of sulfur into the stratosphere, the upper part of the atmosphere above the weather. And that sulfur pollution actually blocked a certain fraction of the sun's rays and cooled the planet by a degree Fahrenheit over a year. And so scientists have thought, well, geez, if we could you know, try this so-called Pinatubo option, as they call it, we might be able to mimic that cooling effect, but do it with engineering. The problem is that among the side effects that volcanoes cause is that they can rob the planet of the sort of solar energy which drives rainfall. And that solar energy drives rainfall by evaporating moisture. And what we saw after Pinatubo, actually, and there was a paper about this, is that since there was less solar radiation striking the Earth, there was less evaporation, and streams, you know, monitors on streams showed less water surging through them, and there was a measure of less precipitation. And so the fear is that if you were to exercise this Pinatubo option, for example, and put up your own sulfur pollution into the stratosphere, you might rob the planet of energy needed for rain.
Eli Kintish, your book, Hack the Planet, really explores some of the upsides and a whole lot of the downsides of monkeying with the planet. It shows some of the unintended consequences of technological experiments that have already been done. You have these little vignettes throughout the book of ways in which human beings have tried to correct some imbalance in the environment and have ended up screwing it up even more. For example, one of the things you talk about is unintended consequences, is the attempt to clean up the air might even be exposing us to even more sunlight, even more heating. If we can't even clean up the atmosphere for our own health without running into a problem, then how do you deal with this conundrum of even sticking our toe into the idea of geoengineering?
The short answer is as cautiously as possible. We're kind of doing inadvertent geoengineering right now, and people don't really appreciate this. As we clean the air of traditional air pollutants, mostly sulfates, which come from diesel engines and mostly from power plants, as we clean the air over cities from that pollution, we reduce an important sort of cooling tool. Those particles actually scatter away from the Earth a fraction of the sun's rays, and that's what, one of the reasons you see a kind of dark haze over cities when it's smoggy. And so we've actually realized that that cooling effect, that these aerosol particles that we put up as a result of traditional air pollution, that could have this really big global effect. And it's a mysterious effect, though, and scientists don't know if it's responsible for a small fraction of the warming, something like, let's say, a quarter of the warming that the greenhouse gases are causing might be offset by this aerosol effect from pollution, or it might be as much as a half. And that is a big difference, because if we're masking right now through this inadvertent geoengineering as much as a half of the warming that the greenhouse gases are causing, that means as we clean our air, we're going to see a lot more warming with the same greenhouse gas pollution. And it also means that the climate conundrum that we've gotten ourselves into is worse than we know.
Now, there are two basic approaches that you talk about in your book, Hack the Planet, to geoengineering. One is to deflect sunlight, and the other is one of which we've already talked about, the injecting of sulfur aerosols into the atmosphere, the Pinatubo option. And the other is to take CO2, carbon dioxide, out of the atmosphere. Could you explain these two methods and then tell us which do you think are the most promising?
So first, let's step back and say why we're in this problem. The greenhouse gases are sort of common pollutants, which it turns out warm the planet more than we thought they did. And they do that by trapping heat that's reflected by the surface of the planet before it can get back out to space. So that's the greenhouse effect. And so the two ways that scientists have thought of dealing with this problem is first to reduce the greenhouse effect, and that's by lowering our emissions of greenhouse gases, but also to cool the planet directly through geoengineering. But geoengineering has these two sides. You could cool the planet, but as we said with the Pinatubo option, you know, putting up volcano-like pollution into the stratosphere, or other methods like brightening clouds, or even changing the brightness of the ocean surface. There's a guy who's suggested giant swaths of bubbles that you could add to the ocean, and those bubbles would make the surface of the ocean brighter. But that's the cooling side. To deal more directly with the problem of the greenhouse gases, we might want to go beyond simply cutting our greenhouse gas emissions by using solar panels or using windmills. We might actually want to suck the carbon dioxide right out of the sky. And so scientists have started to build machines which might actually filter the atmosphere of carbon dioxide. And in terms of the most promising methods, I mean, one thing that cools the planet is to put a roof on your house that's white, and that has added benefit of keeping your house cool in the summertime. They don't think that white roofs could have a global effect if everyone did them. There's just, turns out cities are just too small to have that kind of effect, and some other reasons. But that's a good way to cool the planet that has the added benefit of cooling your house. In terms of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, I mean, stopping deforestation leads to putting up less carbon in the air, and it allows the Amazon and other tropical forests to continue to take in carbon dioxide. Building carbon-sucking machines is actually probably a pretty good idea, just because we might need them, and there's really no downside in the future to sucking that carbon dioxide out of the sky. The problem is it's way too expensive, and so we need research on it to find out if it could work, you know, 20, 30 years from now.
Where do you put all that carbon once you've sucked it out of the sky?
Well, let's hope that 20, 30 years from now we have a better solution than we do now. I mean, right now the idea with coal plants is instead of spraying their carbon dioxide into the air, it's to shove it deep down into the ground. But there are some possible problems with that, although so far initial studies suggest that it will be fairly feasible to do. It may be more expensive than we hope, and it could add considerable cost to everyone's energy bills to have to store the carbon dioxide underground that we right now spray into the sky. But with the carbon dioxide sucking methods right now, the best idea is to put it underground.
People talk about carbon capture and storage or clean coal. Do you think the major problem is that it's too expensive, or do you see other downsides?
Right now, no one would mind if it was cheap to simply take the coal plants we have and start emitting the carbon that's coming from and then putting it underground. The problem is that coal is a dirty business. You know, like oil, like we're seeing in the Gulf of Mexico, you know, it's an inherently unsustainable way to get energy. And so one fear that people have is that by allowing so-called carbon capture and storage as a solution for coal, you simply keep coal plants around, whereas maybe they say the better solution is to ban coal plants or to ban new ones, at least, that don't store carbon dioxide.
Now, another carbon-sucking solution you talk about in the book, Hack the Planet, Eli Kintish, is Calera cement, turning carbon into limestone, basically. Talk about that and tell us, what are some of the challenges of that as well?
If you think about where oil comes from and where coal comes from, basically you have creatures, you know, that form limestone as the shells of their, they basically have coral shells, kind of bone shells that's made, and then as that gets processed under the weight of the ocean, it forms limestone, and then as it gets further and further processed, it turns into other things like coal and oil and natural gas. So the idea is that when the CO2 is emitted by a coal plant, why not use chemical means to turn it back into limestone, into hard stuff? And so this is how animals make shells. This is how animals make pearl. This is how we make bones and teeth. We make hard stuff out of carbon. But the problem with this method is that it's really unproven, and that while the company selling it, Calera, is convinced that it could be the solution for coal plants in the future, there are a lot of questions surrounding it, and it's yet to really prove itself as a viable alternative to simply shoveling the carbon dioxide underground.
Now, you are talking in the book, Hack the Planet, about solutions that are really worldwide in application, are geoengineering, changing the climate, hopefully in a good direction. One of those is the fertilization of oceans by iron, talking about using even a very small amount of iron to change the oceans. Why would this work? What's this about?
So in my book, I describe a kind of fascinating figure named John Martin, who towards the end of his life realized that one of the reasons that whole swaths of the ocean have lots of nutrients but no sea life, essentially, is that a trace nutrient, iron, is missing. And one of these places is the Southern Ocean, which is the ocean that rings Antarctica. And so Martin proposed that maybe in the past there was more iron in these waters, and that's why there were more plankton, which is the main plant of the ocean, and that plankton, you know, allowed there to be much more sea life than there is now. And so he said, well, geez, maybe we can provide the iron ourselves. And he made this famous comment, as he said in his best Dr. Strangelove voice, give me a tanker of iron and I can give you an ice age. So several companies have looked into the idea of adding the trace nutrient of iron to the ocean, because that trace nutrient could catalyze the growth of algae, which would suck carbon dioxide out of the sky. And as that algae was eaten or it died, it would bring the carbon dioxide that was in the air before to the bottom of the ocean. And in my book, I describe this sort of revolutionary mission by Indian and German scientists to try this on a large scale, because iron fertilization had been attempted by a number of scientists working on small scale, like small experiments, and they wanted to do it something like, I don't remember, but many tons, I think it was 10 tons of iron they were going to add to the ocean. And that that amount would catalyze enormous blooms of algae. And this ran into a lot of controversy because the environmental ministry of Germany was at odds with the science ministry, which had approved the mission. It was a German ship. And so I describe in my book how the scientists, in the middle of their ocean cruise, and really in the absolute end of the earth, deep in the southern hemisphere, in just the most desolate seas you can imagine, they were up all night writing scientific papers to convince the government to allow them to do this experiment. It turned out the experiment didn't work for a number of reasons. Mostly they were growing the wrong kind of algae. But it's a good example of how controversial this topic can be.
Well, it's controversial also because algae blooms can lead to sucking all the oxygen out of, I mean, that's what happens in some local areas where there are algae blooms in the ocean because of, agricultural fertilizers.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you have to be careful when you're messing with large-scale systems. A number of scientists have basically said that iron fertilization is a bad solution to our global climate problem and our global carbon problem. On the other hand, I point out, we put up 8 billion tons of carbon every year with man-made emissions. You know, if this particular solution could take as much as, you know, 1/8 of that, 1 million tons a year, and store it in the ocean, which already takes in many hundreds of times more carbon than that by natural means, it shouldn't be taken off the table. And that's what other scientists think.
You sound more positive in talking with us here than you actually do in your book, Eli Kentish, in Hack the Planet. In the book, you do explore a lot of the dangers of geoengineering. And I found fascinating, toward the end of the book, you also talk about geoengineering as being a right-wing darling, that this is a solution that's being touted by the right wing, a right wing that has for a long time denied the reality of global warming. Talk about the politics around this, and why are conservatives, right-wing conservatives, interested in this?
I mean, I can't get into anyone's head per se, but I will say that the idea of geoengineering does allow discussion of a number of kind of classic talking points when it comes to climate change, that you hear from, you know, folks who want to continue emissions the way they are. The first is that this is a problem about temperature and not about carbon dioxide. And so if you make this a problem of temperature, then a solution which focuses on temperature, like the Pinatubo option, where we block a certain fraction of the sun's rays, that might make more sense than talking about cutting emissions, if that's your worldview. The second thing is that, you know, there's a lot of talk about how difficult or expensive cutting emissions, like Obama wants to do, how expensive that would be. And geoengineering, by contrast, may be something that could be done fairly cheaply, at least initially. I don't think we know quite what the costs would be in terms of the impact on the environment or social costs, or whether this would lead to inequity, or it could even lead to a war, you don't know. But at least initially, you know, the cost of actually putting up pollution into the stratosphere to block 2% of the sun's rays may be on the order of a couple billion dollars a year, which is, frankly, nothing when you think about the global economy. And finally, I think that geoengineering allows us to think about this as a problem which may not require kind of massive changes in our lifestyle, which some people think would be a bad idea. I think what we learned from the BP oil spill is that even if carbon emissions wasn't the problem that it is, you know, there are lots of reasons to trying to be moving towards a more sustainable way of living.
Eli Kentish, your book is Hack the Planet, Science's Best Hope or Worst Nightmare for Averting Climate Catastrophe. It's a great book, and thanks so much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Francesca.
Eli Kentish is a reporter for Science Magazine, and he's also written for Slate, Discover, and The New Republic. You can read an excerpt from Hack the Planet at writersvoice.net. And you can delve deeper into the politics of climate change and geoengineering with more links you'll find on our website. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows.
Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.
This little song that I'm singing about, people you know is true. If you black and gotta work for a living now, this is what they will say to you. This is, if you was white, you'd be alright. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I was in a place one night, they was all having fun. They was all buying beer and wine, but they would not sell me none. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, you'd stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. To employ me at office, the number I got in line. They called everybody's number, but they never did call mine. They said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, you'd stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. Me and a man was working side by side. This is what it meant. They was paying him a dollar an hour, and they was paying me 50 cents. I said, if you was white, you'd be all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I hope built this country, and I fought for it too. Now I guess that you can see what a black man have to do. He says, if you was white, she's all right. If you was brown, stick around. But as you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back. I hope win sweet victory with my little plying hoe. Now I want you to tell me, brother, what you're gonna do about the old Jim Crow. Now if you was white, she's all right. If you was brown, stick around. But if you black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back.
Virgil Kane is my name, and I drove on the Danville train till so much cavalry came and tore up the tracks again. We were hungry, just barely alive. I took the train to Richmond that fell. It was a time I remember oh so well. There goes the Robert E. Lee. Now I don't mind, I'm chopping wood, and I don't care if the money's no good. Just take what you need and leave the rest. But they should never have taken the very best. Thank you. people were singing, they went la 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 la.
And now for something completely different.